Comrades and friends, hello. This is your Highlands Bunker podcast. This week's episode is going to be sort of a news update. There's lots of news going on, happenings, comings and goings, and so forth. And we're going to start it off by this little piece of news. This is an ACLU press release, March 14th, 2024. Today, the ACLU of Delaware filed an opening brief with the Superior Court of Delaware on behalf of the Delaware Call, an independent news media group that covers Delaware issues. The brief calls for state agencies to comply with the Delaware Freedom of Information Act and release public records relating to the division of the Delaware State Police of the Delaware Department of Safety and Homeland Security. In their FOIA request, the Delaware Call sought basic employment data about the state police, such as officers' names, job titles, annual salaries, certification statuses, and basic demographic information that is commonly made available for other public officials and is affirmatively disclosed by other police forces nationwide. The Delaware Call did not request addresses or contact information. In its refusal to disclose the public records, the Delaware State Police inappropriately cited, quote, privacy and, quote, public safety exceptions to FOIA and reliance on the law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights, Leobor, to deprive the public of information that should be made available. Quote, FOIA exists to equip the public with information about governmental operations so that the government actors can be held accountable to the people they serve, says Dwayne Bensing, ACLU of Delaware legal director. When state agencies repeatedly deprive the public of information that they are legally owed, it perpetuates a culture of secrecy that leaves the general public with a lack of trust in those officials. We're in the shadow of Rockford Tower. We're behind enemy lines. We're in the belly of the Delaware Way beast. And friends, as you know, this is a big news update on the Highlands Bunker podcast. I'm very excited to introduce our guest today because about a year and a half ago, he just reached out, and we can talk a little bit about it, to start like doing reporting about getting police certification data. Journalists from the Invisible Institute, and it sort of took off from there. Sam, thank you for stopping in, Sam Steklow, the Invisible Institute.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, very cool. And Jordan Howe is also here.
Happy to be back.
Jordan helped the call and Sam sort of report this last end of it. I was involved, you know, in the FOIA request and some of the stuff beforehand. But the reporting at the end that we put in the call, I was not involved with, and you can be assured that I wasn't, because the title of it is Delaware opened up access to some police misconduct records, but still denies requests for basic police data. That's a Jordan Howe headline.
And that is, I'm pretty sure Sam wrote that.
That's a little long. Sam, I'm going to have to...
I don't see anything wrong with it.
I mean, it's factually accurate. Yes. It's definitely accurate. So before we get to like the what's happening now, I want to give you guys an opportunity to sort of talk about the background of this. As I said, Sam, you sort of reached out about some other work you were doing. So I'd kind of like you to talk about, you know, what other kind of work you were doing and how you came to sort of start doing it, and then how we kind of fit into it.
Yeah, thanks. So I work with the Invisible Institute, which is a nonprofit that's based in Chicago. It's been around since about 2014. And some of the projects that we do, we are a nonprofit kind of public accountability journalism organization. And so that kind of takes a lot of different avenues. We publish, you know, more traditional written or kind of documentary investigations. But we also work on public data projects using police data. And so our organization kind of was created around this appellate court decision that our founding director, Jamie Calvin, was part of in Illinois that, long story short, is basically that most police misconduct records in Illinois are public record under Illinois FOIA. And from there, the Invisible Institute, I wasn't there yet, but the organization was able to request not only the records, but underlying data for decades of police misconduct complaints for the Chicago Police Department, going back to the good data is about 2000s. And then we do have many decades earlier, but it kind of gets spottier the further you go back. But we published this in a website called the Citizens Police Data Project, cpdp.co, which is a little bit of a hard URL to say clearly, but that is a tool where anybody can go look up any Chicago police officer between about the 80s and around 2018 is when the data was last updated. We're currently working on the most recent update, which should be coming out in the next couple months. And you can see their complaint, use of force, awards, if they've won any awards. You can see their salary and their rank changes over time. And you can download the underlying documents for a lot of the cases that we have in the database. And so I came on about 2017 after this database has been around for a few years. And you know, gradually my role started to become, well, what can we do outside of the city of Chicago to kind of broaden our work to make police records really accessible to residents, to journalists, to lawyers, to researchers, to activists, and you know, the really wide constituency of people that we've seen utilize our data in Chicago. And so part of that has been looking at police certification data in every state, which is basically the list or database of officers who the state has granted a license to be a police officer, which is a little bit like a nursing license, a teacher's license, a bar license for an attorney. It's the piece of paper or you know, digital piece of paper that allows them to work as a police officer and be hired and serve in that function. And a lot of states have actually given us that data. Over 30, it's a little bit of a squishy number, but over 30 have released certification data, and 27 have released full employment history data, which is basically every person who has been certified or who has a license, as it's called in some states, and where they've worked within the state. And we're doing this because we want to be able to look at officers after they leave a department, after they're either disciplined or after they resign, or for whatever reason. We know that often police will leave a department and go to a new one and the same issues will continue. It's something that we saw in Chicago after they would leave the CPD and they would leave our data systems. And so that kind of work led us to request police certification and employment history data around the country. There are some states like Delaware where we were not able to make a request. Because of the residency issues, I'm sure you guys have talked about all the silly things about Delaware FOIA on this show, but you have to be a Delaware resident.
Yeah, the one thing I'll say is that when we got sort of connected and I found out the stuff you were doing, you know, we had to have like a real early heart to heart about the Leo Bohr and the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights and the very unique little shire that we have carved out for ourselves here, the little tax haven of Delaware. So yeah, we got a group of subject matter experts together and had to sort of tell Sam, yeah, here it's a different story. So,
and so you said there are 47 states that have released some type of data. Right. And you said, so are there just, did I count that right? And so there are just three states, Delaware included, that have either released no data or you couldn't make a request?
No, sorry. So it's the 27 and 30 shouldn't be.
It was 27, 17 and 30.
Around 30 have released just the certification data, which means a point in time, these are the officers who are certified. And then of those, 27 have also released the employment history for those officers. So not only where they are right now, but where they've been. So The exact number of states that are denying us data is also a little bit sticky because it gets into, well, there are some states that will give us the certification data, but not the employment history data. But it's about 14 states that are giving us a hard denial. Nevada actually just recently released their certification, but not their employment history data. So Delaware is in a very small minority of states that is not releasing any data, not three, but a very small minority.
Lovely. Yeah, the other thing that you said that resonated one of the first times we spoke was something you said you focused on when you were describing sort of the background is the officers being able to move state to state and move around without being able to sort of ensure their certification or check what they've done and what misconduct they've done. And we had that situation locally. With an officer who was involved with a very violent act and was tried for it and acquitted, and then moved on and became, an officer that was involved in a murder. So, it all kind of came together, but it was a long sort of haul to sort of figure out where we were going to go with it. Do you know what I mean? I mean, you were sort of involved. We had a big team. Sam was always driving it, but we didn't really. Shout out to Cheyenne Miller, by the way. She did a lot of work, a lot of work on it, maybe 6, 9 months ago.
And what I want, yeah, one of the things I wanted to ask Sam is, I remember early on when we were talking about how to craft these FOIA requests that we'd be sending out to like multiple state police agencies. I'm just really curious, how did how did we get to Delaware, right? Because you've done done these types of so many of these projects before, before you reached out to us to do something similar here in Delaware. What were some of the, I guess successes and failures you encountered, in the just kind of, labyrinthine FOIA process for all these different states, working with I'm sure initially getting denied and then having to, appeal denials and, just go through that very messy process.
Yeah, so we actually started requesting certification data in 2019. That was part of a project that we were doing, ended up being with USA Today. It was called Tarnished Brass. And the final product really only looked at decertified officers, and kind of that process. Because around that time, a lot of the kind of conversation around state level oversight of policing hadn't. A lot of the conversation was really just about the act of decertifying an officer and not necessarily about the fact of, well, were they certified because they were already certified in another state and should they have been certified in the first place? So, but we had been requesting a lot of the certification data from basically every state. And that doesn't mean that we got it in every state, but we had kind of started that process. And so in 2022, there's an organization at Stanford called Big Local News. And there was someone who had been on the USA Today project, also involved in kind of restarting this effort to get all of the certification and employment history data, because we knew that officers frequently are able to use what's often called reciprocity processes to get a certification in a different state because they were already certified in one state. And so they're able to skip basic training, they're able to skip most of the the background investigation that a department has to do. They might
Just
do
kind
it
of
a
get
little bit,
fast-tracked into a new job.
right? They might do a little bit less of a check on this officer because they already hold the certification, and it's cheaper for them because they don't have to pay for this officer to go through training. So we
There's
knew
an incentive
that,
there.
yeah, and I mean, a lot of police departments have been talking about shortages or not being able to hire as many officers, and kind of regardless of whether there are true shortages, if they're feeling pressure to hire more officers, there a lot of experts that I've spoken to have warned that this could allow officers with histories of misconduct to other departments to be more easily hired because they are kind of feeling this pressure and providing these incentives if, because they don't have to train these officers. But when we started kind of this effort anew to really push for getting all of the certification data in every state. In 2022, Invisible Institute had actually, with the Colorado Springs Gazette and Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, filed a lawsuit in Colorado, which is actually at the Supreme Court right now, trying to overturn a pretty bad appellate court decision. But we had already started legal appeals in some states and began a legal strategy to where we were denied data, look into what resources we could take advantage of to obtain that data. And we had also seen in California in 2007, the Supreme Court there had considered whether this exact data should be public and found that it should be. And so we knew that there was good precedent that we could rely on in California and, in other states to point to the fact that there is no issue, no harm to police departments in releasing this data. And there's actually significant public interest in it. So Delaware is one of a handful of states where we've gone ahead and filed legal appeals. Utah is another one. Michigan is another. New York is another where we have pending appeals.
And that's one of the things that was just like, just so kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say goofy, but just like so nonsensical about one of the denial is that this, releasing this very basic information could put police officers, at risk. And it's just like these officers who, are already put into uniform and have a, literally have like a name tag on so that they can be identified as police officers, like somehow like having this basic demographic, or not even demographic, just this basic, ID data would somehow put them at more risk. Like that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and it's kind of the most basic piece of information that you could expect about a public official. It's just their name and the fact of their employment. And I think it's something that a lot of cities will make their salary data or, information public. There are websites like the state actually pointed us to a different website that they had released salary data for called Open the Books. And when you look at Open the Books, it seems pretty clear that they got this data through a FOIA request. And so the state was basically trying to say, well, no, you can't have this data, but here's somewhere else where we've already released what we're saying is some subset of this data. And so, yeah, I mean, a lot of the arguments really amount to, if you drill down to it, releasing the name of a law enforcement officer will result in their privacy being invaded, will result in their safety being, coming into question. And then when in many states, when you ask them to really prove this out, they come back with statistics about how dangerous it is to be a police officer and specific cases where police officer have been harmed. And obviously, it's not the most dangerous job, but it's not the safest job. And obviously, there are police officers who have been harmed. But often it's not because their name was released in a public records request. It's because of the fact that they're a law enforcement officer and someone saw them in uniform. Like, I guess the Dallas sniper situation, it wasn't because those officers had their names out there. It was because they were in a uniform. And
It's
unfortunately,
mostly
that's what that person decided to do.
automobile accidents, let's be honest. It's
And
mostly
a lot of the time, that's what it is as
chases,
well.
heart attacks, that type of thing.
Or it's a specific action they've taken, and that's why a law enforcement officer was harmed. Or even if they come back with examples of like, oh, well, there were nasty things said about this person online, and their address was posted. It's often because of an action that they took, not simply because they're a law enforcement officer who appeared on a list of thousands of other police officers.
And we're not even asked, we didn't even ask for addresses though, right? Just names. And
No,
like,
we did
so.
not ask for any personal information like that. We are asking really just for professional information about their work as public servants in the state of Delaware.
And they also, I mean, cops show up to court all the time and also testify in cases all the time. Again, it's not like these, people have no interaction, with the community. And like, one of the things that's also, I think, interesting about this is, what you just said about, asking for basic data is how Leobor can is sometimes just used kind of like as this blanket exemption, to basically deny any type of, request, for data about police officers. And but that's not always like the way it's written in the law, right? Like I believe in Delaware's law, it specifically says police data that is related to, investigations, right, or other things of that nature. And correct me if I'm wrong, but like. how much of a role does this, I guess, play in the work that you do, right? Like, kind of, you know, I'm almost thinking about like the velociraptors in Jurassic Park, like where they're going around the, you know, the electric fence, you know, trying to find, you know, the weak spots where, like, you know, looking at the way that states are enforcing Leobor, that is perhaps, you know, that is not lawful or the way the law was intended. And then, you know, trying to, if you, since a lot of states, you know, will not repeal Leobor, at least trying to have the courts be more clear about what is public record under Leobor.
Yeah, I mean, the way that Delaware, the Delaware, I guess, Department of Homeland Security, or the AG's office who's representing them, have claimed Leobor in this denial and in this lawsuit, it's not very clear. And that's something that the ACLU Delaware brief kind of gets into, is that they're just kind of throwing it at the wall, saying Leobor, and then just claiming that that's a denial that they can give us. There is really not a lot of legal analysis where they go into why it's applicable to the data that we asked for, even though they cited it as a reason. And so there's a whole section in the ACLU brief titled "The Leobor Statute Does Not Apply to the FOIA Context," which is making an argument that it really only deals with civil process. And I think that's something that hasn't really been fought in the Delaware courts yet, and I think is a really interesting point, because a lot of states will, and a lot of departments will, assume that a requester, A, doesn't know their rights and doesn't know the law, and B, doesn't know that they have the right to enforce their rights. And so how that often plays out is they will just say, oh, well, in, you know, some legalese, citation XYZ means that we can't release this. We're so sorry, we want to, but we're our hands are tied. And if you look at citation XYZ, it doesn't actually say that. And you go back to them and you say, okay, well, has there been some court that has, you know, interpreted it in the way that you're saying? Because I'm reading it and I don't really understand it. And then either, you know, they understand that you know your rights and you probably know how to enforce them, or they force you to do what the state of Delaware has done, which is obtain legal counsel, which the ACLU of Delaware has done pro bono here, and fight it in court, which is what has needed to happen, and has needed to happen in the state of Michigan, New York, Utah, and elsewhere. We've had to bring on attorneys, either in-house or, you know, a lot of First Amendment clinics have been really helpful, and groups like the ACLU of Delaware, where we have to kind of bring together this broad public interest coalition and say, no, the names of law enforcement officers are public in this state. You can't just say Leobor or any of these other personal privacy, you know, safety. You have to actually say, this is how releasing this person's name will invade their privacy so much that it will, the public interest is overweighed by this person's private interest. And I mean, we'll see in Delaware if that's what they're able to say. In California, they said that's certainly not the case.
Yeah, I do want to mention one thing tied into what you said, completely outside the realm of the brief or the lawsuit at all. Just about like my experience, and this is probably a good time to shout out Casey Danoff, who is working with Dwayne Bensing at the ACLU. She's a fellow. She's at Penn Law. And she was very helpful for me, because I'm just a person sort of representing a independent journalism collaborative who is just making FOIA requests. As I said, Cheyenne was helpful doing some of these too. And like I got some of the initial stuff that you were talking about, Sam. It was like, yeah, you know, this is why we're doing it. And Casey and I would look at it and we would say, well, ask them this question. You ask the question and then they say, Are you? Maybe you should seek outside counsel. You know, they just say weird, you know, weird stuff. Like they know when people are going to be able to sort of exercise their rights, but they're just, you know, they sort of forced our hand here, and so that's what we're doing. The other thing I wanted before we sort of move to another topic, and this is another question for Sam. You were also very helpful from just sort of like, whether you want to call it organizing or a network of sort of independent journalists. You were working with a law clinic at George Washington University who was extremely helpful in sort of talking through sort of just the legal issues, sort of not even for me, even outside the lawsuit, just like what's going on. And that was something that was a relationship that I guess you guys had or you had with them in the Invisible Institute with this other broader work. So it was very interesting that you were able to add that. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, there's a professor named Jeff Gutman who runs the Public Justice Advocacy Clinic at George Washington Law. I mean, he's actually representing Invisible Institute and Washington City paper and trying to get records about lateral officers who come into the Washington Metro Police Department, which they are likewise not releasing, even though in D.C. the salary data for the district is available on the website. You can look it up. You can download it. And so theoretically, all of these officers' names are already out there. We have them downloaded. We just want to know which ones came from other agencies, and they know who they are, and they won't tell us. Kind of through this work of when we you know sat down and we're like, okay, we are getting data in these states, and that's great. We're going to start, you know, cleaning it and seeing what we can do with it and talking to journalists and other folks in those states who might want to work with it. But what about, you know, the rest of the country where we're not getting this data? I started working with a lot of these law school clinics and others, and I was put in touch with Jeff Gutman, who mostly does, I believe, federal FOIA cases. But he was interested in this work and thought it was really valuable. And we were talking about states where it had been difficult to find legal representation because I think we just hadn't connected with ACLU of Delaware yet. And he agreed, even though he's not barred in Delaware and was not familiar, to have his students work on this with Casey. And I think they actually helped draft a portion of it with her, even though they're not representing, but they assisted with the case. And so they've been incredibly helpful.
Yeah. It was just a great, I sort of alluded to it before. And I want to brag a little bit to a certain part of our audience, you know, the Carl Stomberg fans out there. This was a months-long organizing exercise.
I see
where we brought to bear disparate resources, where frankly I just made connections and I just let like Sam work with Jordan and Misty and Dwayne and all that. Like I was like, hey, you guys are doing great work. So I do want to mention that part of it. And again, joking aside, I do want to thank Sam again for like reaching out and sort of sticking through this sort of weird process that we have. It was a really sort of great day for everybody who's sort of involved with Delaware Call stuff. I can tell you that I got a lot of congratulations from some pretty esteemed folks who were happy this was happening. And really, Sam and the work of the Invisible Institute has to get, you know, their share of the credit here. It was great working with you, I have to say.
I really have enjoyed working with the both of you and Cheyenne and Misty and everyone else. You know, we talked a little bit about kind of the process of where we started, but part of it was that I saw that this was an issue that was important to Delaware Call. I think Misty's series that she wrote about Lee Obor was incredibly helpful. And obviously made clear that this was an issue of importance. And so, yeah, that's one of the reasons that I reached out to you guys and we're working together. And everywhere that we're working, Invisible Institute's based in Chicago. I'm actually based in Florida after having lived in Chicago for 7 years. But where we're working outside of kind of our immediate knowledge area and kind of comfort zone, it's always with the people who are doing this work on the ground and with the people who are most impacted and can make the data and the records that we're going after most accessible to those most impacted by police misconduct and police violence. So that's, our mission in Invisible Institute is helping citizens to build their capacity to hold public institutions accountable. And that really happens that.
So it was Misty's series that that caused you, like, when you were looking at Delaware, then, like, it was her series that you were just like, oh, I should reach out. And
no, he reached out before.
Oh, that was before that. Oh,
okay. I'm pretty sure we spoke well before that.
My memory is that I had read Misty's work, at least the first one, before, but maybe it came out around the same time. Maybe it overlaps.
Okay, so
because he reached out to Drew first, right?
I'm not going to say anything bad about Misty. That's not going to happen because she's a solid friend of show and colleague now as well. And is she my boss? Is she not my boss? Who's to say? We don't know. That's the funny part of it. Like, we're all kind of working together in a system, and it's like sort of guerrilla warfare. You don't line up straight.
And, goes to show also, you just never know. Sometimes, you report on something, you write something up, you never know who it can reach. And, before you know it, people are filing FOIA requests and lawsuits against the state of Delaware. What a great outcome.
And that's my goal, too, is hopefully, I don't live in Delaware, and I don't foresee myself moving from, I just moved here a little while ago. So my goal is that more people in Delaware and everywhere else that we're doing this work is they take up, the mantle and see what we're doing and hopefully are able to keep pushing forward. And hopefully this is helpful in doing that.
And I would be remiss if I didn't say this, because there are going to be people listening to this who are our friends, our journalist friend. We call them journalist friends, real journalists, nomad, people who talk as a nomad. You know what I'm talking about. They have, we'll just say, multivarious corporate ties. And while they don't like it, they have to sort of abide by that. And they're very, 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 very jealous of what we're doing. So there is a real desire here to, again, and it sort of makes to get what we're owed legally, basically, and that was just a shout out to our boys out there who are going to be very mad that we're doing this, but hey, sometimes things lead to lawsuits. What can you do?
I just looked, and I think we talked the same month that Misty's first piece came out, so it's important.
Maybe you guys are on a vibe.
I think so.
That's wild. Yeah, and I will say, Misty was very good about writing those. She was very particular, and if she missed like a deadline by a day, she was very like, I'm going to get it to you as soon as possible. And then she did. But yeah, I as we went along with that, and also shout out to someone who helped with part five of that, which, you know what? This is a good way to start a promotion. Part five of that from John Afredo, who has since moved on to another position, helped to talk about some of the things we wanted to do to get past that we really didn't get past. And this is something, Sam, that the next thing we're going to be working on. So here's a big commercial for it. As a next step, because all we got with the reform of Leobor, as everybody on this call knows, is the Pol Pot, you know, the Pol Pot changes or Pod Pat changes and post. We had copped, now we have post. So we didn't really get, you know, any change. So what everybody said last year was, we're going to take the next step. This is the first part, you know, yes, people had to eat shit last year, and they didn't get what they wanted. The next step is very narrow, easy thing. We need to get defense attorneys in criminal court, police misconduct records, just like the attorneys in civil court, when they're making a lawsuit for compensation, get under the rules of evidence. We need to be able to get them in criminal court. Very easy bill. It's a draft bill right now. And we're gonna make that second step. Many people, Tizzy Lockman, Hoffner, many people want to take that next step. So let's do it. So that's what we're working on. That's our next thing, is sort of like being able to get police misconduct records and least and get people on a level footing. So
I'm sure it's nothing I need to tell you, but it's crazy that it's taking this long to begin even thinking about complying with a Supreme Court decision that's been around since the early 60s.
Well, here we go. This is it, folks. This is what we're doing. We're fighting decades-long battles.
This could cross over into another gubernatorial or governor's administration. God only knows how long this will take.
Speaking of which, Sam, if you want to stay on and listen to us jam about local shit, feel free. This is the time when I'm going to probably crack open one more beer, and Carl would play the interstitial music, and then we'll talk about like some local stuff. So the first thing is sort of like a serious thing. The people I'm working with is a very seasoned defense attorney in the state, who is the head of the Office of Defense Services, Kevin O'Connell. But his lifelong work really is abolishing the death penalty. And there was a little bit of a move in Delaware to actually pass a constitutional amendment today that could possibly, within a short period of time, a few years, actually ban it constitutionally in Delaware. So I'm really happy for my man Kevin, because I know this was a nice day for him. So shout out. Carl, you looked it up earlier. So it passed a committee today. It does need, as a constitutional amendment. So let me give you a little background. Representative Sean Lynn, Dover Esquire, has two bills. One is a constitutional amendment, which, as Carl will tell us, requires not only a larger vote percentage, but it also has to pass over two sessions, which would amend the Constitution. But he has also introduced a bill that would, from a statutory standpoint, ban the death penalty in Delaware, that could be overturned by statute, which would be a little bit easier, obviously, than overturning a constitutional amendment. So first of all, Carl, fact check me on that. Did I get that right? And also, what happened today? Give us the deets.
Yep. So you require a 2/3 majority, two sessions in a row. So if it were to pass this year, it would also have to pass next year or in 2026. And yeah, it has to pass with that margin twice. And then for today, it was in the House Administration Committee, which is where they put all the constitutional amendments, and it passed unanimously, apparently, with, both all the Democrats and all the Republicans voting it out of committee.
Yeah, what do you have the Republicans in that committee?
That would be Mike Ramone and Lyndon Yurick.
Okay. Well, one of those people I know for a fact is always sort of seems like he's in a primary battle, you know. So maybe that, what's that?
General.
Oh, general. Oh, right. Oh, excuse me. Yeah, I forgot. Thank you, Carl. But it's in an election battle. And so here's where the stick...
Yurick is as well.
Okay. Oh, I see. I did not know that. So who is where is that district, and who is running in that?
That is like Camden, Wyoming, essentially, just like south of Dover.
South of
and
Dover,
it
yeah.
Went Biden by like a percentage point in 2020, but he is still like Urich has historically done very well there. Like he cleaned up pretty handily in 2020 and 2022, if I remember correctly. But yeah, so him and Ramon are the two in House leadership now.
Just very quickly want to drop my years-long complaint against the Delaware process for amending the state constitution that does not involve a vote of citizens, but rather two consecutive votes from the legislature. Is it the only state to do that, Carl? I'm pretty sure it's the only state that does that. Or is there like one other state? Like,
I don't know the specifics, but I think our particular process is unique. I don't know if any other state has the no. I mean, there's definitely other states that don't have the referendum. I don't know if there's any other states where you have to do it twice in a row.
Yeah, this state does.
That was actually
referendum.
How the
that should be the title of this episode. Our particular process is unique.
Yeah.
I think no
in many
shit,
ways.
No
and across
if I remember
departments.
Correctly, the 1776 Pennsylvania Constitution had a similar thing where you had to like pass a piece
talking?
Of legislation and then
we're talking about
have a
we're
new
middle,
election.
We're in the
and
middle
then
of
pass
insurrection
again.
Fucking.
But that was just for any piece of legislation. It was 1 year terms, not 2 year terms. So.
Yeah. And the other thing, I think we mentioned it. I don't know what we were. Oh, we were talking about the voting thing, which is another thing that's come up now because they got screwed because they did the January 6th. And we still have to play that board game, by the way. Do you know that Bill bought the board game from chewing out about January 6th insurrection? Yeah. We're doing a whole episode about it. I'm playing for real. Anyway, so the Republicans who had voted for the amendment to do mail ballots and like catch up with the 2000-aughts changed their vote because elections were after January 6th, elections are fixed. So you can't vote for it. So then they didn't vote for it. And we talked about it. And the thing is, the only thing we could think of the logic is, if two-thirds of the legislature votes for this constitutional amendment, but the polity doesn't like it, they have the opportunity to then vote those people out and replace them with people who will not vote it a second time when it has to pass the second. It gives the opportunity for an election. It's the stupidest, as Carl said, we have some unique esoteric bullshit process, but like somebody came up with it 230 years ago, and we can't change it.
Oh, man, it's
it.
Probably older than that. Probably like passed down from the House of Lords or something. God
fucking
only knows.
Magna Carta shit.
Well, Magna Carta is good.
Look, I know the Magna Carta was a deal between the landowners and the gentry. I know all that. Let's not fucking get into it. We don't need to be pedantic about this. Thank God.
Got a lot of shit talking to do.
Choo. Yeah, we do. speaking of shit talking. So, as regular listeners know, we are very critical sometimes of the local newspaper. The local newspaper can tend to really to sort of dive too far into the National Enquirer shit and Gourmet Magazine shit. But one of the things we've been tracking is something that I think, now Carl and Jordan, you're going to have to check me on this. I feel like this story has exceeded the Wegmans. The Wegmans for a while, you couldn't get away from it. That was something. This will never stop. And folks, I'm talking about our local boy, Jimmy Allen. Now, I want to tell you how I was introduced to Jimmy Allen. Like four years ago, Jordan and I are at the fucking pub, probably watching a football, whatever, draining some pints. He goes, I'm going down to this, State Fair concert, whatever. He goes, I'm doing a story for Delaware Today. It's a profile of this guy, this country singer. He's a black guy from Delaware, and he's like charting. And I'm like, I had no idea what the fuck this guy was. I was like, Jordan, what are you talking about? He's like, Jimmy Allen. I'm like, okay. And so you went down there to do the story. Can you, like, I don't know if you've ever told this on the show. Carl will remember. This is actually a very good story. So can you give us your Jimmy Allen story, please?
Wait, so I got the assignment, and, you know, was supposed to, you know, meet up with Jimmy Allen at two concerts, you know, to do a series for Delaware Today, which was published. And which did get first place in the Delaware Press Awards for whatever year that was. And
what category? Profile, dumb profile category?
Yeah, dumb profile category.
I mean,
magazine.
Here's what I want to say. This is embargoed information, but when the Delaware Press Association Awards come out this year, which is going to be in like a week or two, pay close attention to what won the best op-ed in Delaware last year. Anyway,
close attention. And so there are two concerts that I went to. The one was in at Delaware Park Casino in you know, out in between Wilmington and Newark, and then the other was in Harrington at the State Fairgrounds.
So how big was the dude when you went to Delaware Park? Like, I mean, and now he's like a isn't he more like nationally famous? He's not playing like the fucking Paddock.
No, because it wasn't The Voice. What, he was on like one of those, you know, one of those big shows, wasn't he?
One of those shows.
Oh man, so if we need someone with the phone
it
to look it up.
It doesn't matter.
But the Delaware Park show wasn't that big. I don't know, there were probably, you know, maybe 100 people there. But the one at Harrington was huge. And, you know, that was like, you know, like a homecoming show for him, you know, because he's from downstate. And the whole thing was, you know, I had talked to his people and I was supposed to get, you know, some time to interview him. That's not unusual if you're going to be doing a profile for a magazine that they, you know, we were saying like this could be on the cover, you know, and all of that stuff. And so, you know, they were like, oh, yeah, you can interview him before this show and before this show. You know, I was counting on, like, you know, maybe, you know, 30 minutes to an hour, you know, here, 30 minutes to an hour there. You know, didn't happen before the Delaware Park show. You know,
you just got totally shut down.
Just shut down. Did not.
You got nothing.
Have a good, you know, explanation.
They were basically like, you came early, probably.
Yeah.
And then sat through a fucking Delaware Park show. You know, I don't know if it's your type of music or not. And then you were like, hey, afterwards, he's too busy signing autographs for the local lacrosse team.
No. And I mean, music's fine. Like, you know, it's pop country. Like, I'm not, you know, there'd probably be worse things to sit through. But it was, and also Delaware Park. I mean, I kind of like Delaware Park. Like, I don't know. Like, it's like, it has that Atlantic City vibe that I really like. And
you do like, you are Midwest at heart. You're corny. You got corny. You love corny shit.
You know, and so, you know, I do enjoy my time there, you know, seeing a country pop star. And, but didn't get to interview him. You know, so I was just like, you know, I'll start interviewing people in the crowd, you know, asking people why they're here, see if anyone knows them, you know, things like that. You know, then get to the Harrington show and again, get there early, supposed to, you know, get an interview. And, you know, then it was supposed to be like, you know, and like, you know, an hour before the show, then it was like 30 minutes before the show. And then the show is getting ready to start. And they're just like talking about like, and like, you know, I'm like basically radio silence for a little while. And then eventually they say like, oh, we'll give you like, you know, maybe 30 minutes after the show. And by then I was just like, oh shit, I'm not going to get to talk to this guy at all. I'm sitting here, I'm supposed to write this profile. I'm like totally not going to get to talk to him. And so it was like one of those situations where I was just like, well, I have to write about something. Like, so I'm just going to go around and literally just talk to as many people here as I can and ask them like why they're at this
why they love Jimmy Allen.
And like, I heard that like his family would be there and like ended up like, you know, talking to his brother, you know, just like kind of randomly just went outside. I was just like, there's going to be people smoking cigarettes outside. So I'll just go and like stand around all the smokers and just ask them why
they're
there.
This is at the State Fair.
Yeah, this is at the State Fair. And also, I mean, just for like young journalists too, just like 100% easy way to get interviews. You know, if you're in a situation like that, go to the smoking section. You know, people will just be standing around. You know, they'll want to talk. It's
sickos.
You know,
yeah. Sickos. Talk to
you can bum a cigarette too and help calm the nerves because your story is because
your story's tanking and you might not get paid. Number one, your story's tanking. You might not get paid. So you might as well go outside at the Delaware State Fair in Harrington and talk to the fucking people smoking cigs.
And that ended up being the best part of the story, right? Like, not actually, because I ended up talking to, you know, Jimmy Allen, I think, for about 12 minutes. But that was less interesting than talking to all the people, you know, who were there. And just, you know, again, it was.
Do you remember questions you asked him? Did you ask him some E! Entertainment-ass questions?
No, it was actually mostly just trying to, like, you know, get, like, you know, hear about, like, his life and background, like, things, like, going into things that I had read a little bit in, like, other profiles, and I wanted more, like, a little bit more depth, or detail from him. But, and so I started going around, you know, just asking people questions. And, you know, it actually ended up being a lot of fun because it was just kind of a raucous show. Like, it was fun being in Harrington at the state fair. Those people were pacing, you know, just pounding beers and, hooting and hollering. And it was a good time. Yeah, that's my one run-in with Jimmy Allen.
So, folks, if you want more information about Jimmy Allen, it's been out there many, many stories over and over and over again. And just try to Google this episode. Just Google, like, Jimmy Allen Delaware lawsuits. I think that will be right into this episode, and you'll get all the information you need. And that's just that. So. We've talked about this on the mic, off the mic, all that. It has to be on the mic now because I've said it. I gave him plenty of fucking time. I love Eugene. That's just the way that it is, because of, like, the shit I'm doing now, what inspired me to do it, and the people I met. And the things that I think. And so that's not going to change. That probably can't change. I mean, it can't change because it's already happened. But I'm not down with any of this. Today, our governor, our good governor, who I guess he's running for mayor. I asked him. Directly.
Ask him.
This is directly. This is actually
very
a good
directly.
Time. This
Had
is
a very
actually
bad day for him.
this is actually a good time to probably tell this story because it didn't make last episode because we fucked around too much. This is probably a good time for this story because when we were at the State of the State and it blew up, you know, into the interruptions about Gaza and the cops and everything, and sort of chaos, and was interrupted five times, maybe. We were stuck in the lobby at one point. We got locked out of the leg hall at one point. Yes. And then we got back in the lobby, and it's a small, I mean, it's Delaware, so it's this tiny fucking leg hall. And
no big rotunda or anything state folks.
Yeah. So
you walk in, and then there's basically a staircase that takes you up to the second floor, and then like a little room around it. Like, there's not a lot of room for milling about.
Yeah. So, and there's a bunch of chairs and stuff, which is nice because you can kind of lounge and whatever. And so Carney's coming out of the chamber after the speech, and I hear this voice behind me. It's like kind of like we're getting pushed against the people who were there, and they're making like a little alley for him to come out. Jordan goes, "Hey, aren't you going to say something to him? Come on, ask him a question." And I'm fucking jacked about doing it. So I go up and I just ask him, "Are you running for Wilmington mayor?" I'm like, "Are you going to run for mayor of Wilmington? When are you going to announce?" And he was like, "We're looking into it." And I'm like, "Looking into it? People want to know. Come on, are you going to announce?" And then I got nervous, and I was like, "Governor Markell, run for mayor." Because I forgot. I legitimately, seeing him made me nervous, and I called him Governor Markell. I'm sorry. I know he lost a real bad, like I know he got his ass beat by that, and I'm sorry for fucking saying it. Jesus. But anyway, our friend, the square-jawed fucking PowerPoint presentation governor, has endorsed today the gubernatorial campaign of Eugene Young. And you know what?
Congressional campaign.
What did I say?
You said gubernatorial.
Oh, I'm sorry, because I was thinking about fucking Carney again. Thank you. I'm so discombobulated. I'm so sad. It's a dark day. I have... Oh, man. You know what? I have a Eugene for mayor sign. It's not here. I know where it is. It's in this house.
The yellow and blue one?
I don't know. We'll go look for it. Because I know exactly where it is. We'll just go pick it up.
There are two. There's a yellow and blue, and I think one with just his name. Then there was one also that had, like, his face. Like, you know.
Doesn't have his face. Whatever the one with doesn't have his face.
I also worked on Eugene Young's 2016 mayoral campaign, and I think you and I met after Kerry's campaign. But yeah, that was like working on Eugene's campaign was one of the things that like was like the catalyst for getting me like, you know, involved in activism here in Wilmington. Like, yeah, that was it. Just like you said, like, love the guy. Every time I see him, I can't help but smile. I know that's a little.
Yeah, I mean, I've said this before. I had a meet and greet with my neighbors here. Was one of the first. I met Eugene after I got in an argument at a neighborhood, a 40 acres neighborhood meeting. Eugene was there. He was real tall, and I was like, "Oh, somebody told me about you." And then we had a meet and greet here. Actually, the first time I met Soren, but. It's just, here's the way I look at it. You can go into a position, like you can run for political office, and you can be, it seems to me, two types of candidates. Now, you're going to have to fit into the two sort of party system, too. That's sort of overlays on top of this. But you can be a politician who explains to people what their platform is and what they believe in and what they're going to try to do and inspire them to get other people to vote for them to go do that. And then continue to do that and explain why the things that you're doing fits with what you explained that you would do. And you continue to build that base. This is called what Jeremy Corbyn does. The guy has lived in his London neighborhood his whole life, was the leader of the party, got screwed. We're not going to talk about it right now. But that's one way to do it. It's the Medina way. This is what I stand for. I've built a coalition to continue to stand for it. I can explain the decisions I make to show you that I stand for this stuff. Fine. And then you hold that coalition together. You can even build it as you go. Or you squeak through winning by 700 votes or 800 votes or 1,100 votes or 50 votes or whatever, and then you just obfuscate, and you talk to everyone in a tizzy, and you tell them whatever they want to hear. You have a coffee, you have this, you have that, and you never really fucking do anything. You basically say, I'll potentially co-sponsor your bill under a very narrow set of esoteric circumstances, maybe. That's like fighting for the issue. Like, so people got to determine what kind of person they're going to be, what kind of politician they're going to be. And it's very clear what type of politician Eugene's going to be. Okay, I'm not going to hold anybody to this, and actually, like, this could probably hurt people's feelings, so don't, you know what? Here's what we're going to do. We're cutting it off, because I have something to ask you, but I don't want to record it, and so that's it, folks. That's the episode today. It's news. We talked about all sorts of news. I want to thank Sam Stecklow again for coming on, and I'm excited to see where this new action goes. So we'll talk to you later. Left is best.